Indeed. Thank you all so much for coming today. Very excited for today's artist dialogue. I am Alice Dillon. I'm the Associate Director of Arts Worcester. You are all currently sitting in Ricardo Barros's exhibition, An Entanglement of Space and Time. This show is a captivating collection of 360-degree panoramic photographs that resist the traditional directionality, narrative, and temporality that you probably think of when you think of photography. Ricardo Barros is a photographer, writer, curator, and filmmaker whose works are in the permanent collections of museums all over, including the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the Museum of Art of Sao Paulo, Harvard Art Museums, and the Fitchburg Art Museum. In 2023, Ricardo and his wife Heather, also a talented artist, relocated to Fitchburg from New Jersey. Today, Ricardo will be in conversation with Lauren Zumita, director of the Cantor Art Gallery at Holy Cross. Lauren is a familiar face to many in the Arts Worcester community, having previously served as curator of the Fitchburg Art Museum and curatorial assistant of prints, drawings, and photographs at the Worcester Art Museum. Lauren also serves on Arts Worcester's exhibition committee, a group of curators, artists, and professionals who evaluate submissions to Arts Worcester's annual call for solo show proposals, including Ricardo's proposal that he sent in last year. This committee is also tasked with awarding the Marlene and David Persky Present Tense Prize to an artist whose work exemplifies new practices, artistic risk-taking, and excellence in execution. Ricardo was this season's recipient of the prize, so we congratulate him on that. Without further ado, I will hand the mic over to Ricardo and Lauren. They're gonna have conversation for probably about half an hour or so, and we welcome questions at the end of their discussion. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Alice. Hello, everyone. I'd like to also echo my congratulations to Ricardo on this exhibition and winning that prize. It's a delight to have all of you here today. I think you're in for a treat. Ricardo's very skilled at speaking about his work, and I think it's going to be really enlightening, just by way of sort of teasing that. Just right before this, I was talking to somebody who said he was confused, but in the best way possible. And I think that's a really great way to kind of summarize the approach before we learn about what's going on. So I'm delighted to be here. And if I hadn't said it already, thank you to Alice, to Julia, and the team at Arts Worcester for making all this possible.
What do I do now? Okay, so.
Ask away.
Okay, should we stand up so you all can see us? Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll stay standing. That means we won't talk too long. Okay, I'd like to just preface this by saying that I started photography in the landscape tradition with view cameras and black and white and it was all about observing and being out in the landscape. And that's where this evolved from that into a couple of different steps, but to get to here. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is that when I was starting these photographs, I was interested in them as topography. I thought I was going to go and photograph the landscape, a similar approach to what I previously had, but see it differently because the camera saw it differently. And truly, the camera did see it differently, but the work was boring. And I had to figure out why. The reason why was the novelty of this approach is so dramatic that it calls attention to itself. And if that's all it does, it's like a funhouse mirror, gimmicky. And at the same time, I realized that because the process of making these photographs is made over time, to do it in 40, 45 minutes is quick, and it requires making many, many photographs and stitching them together later, a person photographed in one location can reappear in a different location. So when I was assembling my landscape photographs and I noticed that people were reappearing, I realized, well, wait a minute, this is an opportunity to tell stories. And it's the narratives that is what makes these photographs interesting beyond just the technical aspects. And then one last thing is that I tend to spend a lot of time thinking about things. And then I write about them and I make films and all that. So when you listen to me or see my film, you might think, oh, wow, this guy's brilliant. Look at, he was so clear. He knew exactly what he was doing. But in fact, that's not true at all. When I make a photograph, I do it purposefully. You know, I don't carry a camera around all the time. I basically see something and it interests me and I come back specifically to photograph it. And I have an inkling of what I want to photograph. And then in the process of making the print or stitching them together, I begin to see details in what I captured that the camera saw that I didn't see. And for me, that says something about the medium of photography. It's like a prism that refracts light. We can't actually see sunlight. We see what sunlight illuminates. But if you hold a prism to the sunlight, it refracts it. It separates the different wavelengths and you see different colors. That's how I look at these photographs. Yes, I was there, I made it intentionally, but they're refracting observations, and to me, they spur new ideas. And in looking at them, then I start learning new things about the world. So the combination of the distorted topography and the folding of time leads to a whole bunch of different ideas, and I really enjoy playing with those ideas. So the photographs are a jumping off point for me.
That's a great sort of foundational introduction to your work. And I was wondering if you could sort of help us contextualize this body of work. So when did you start doing this? Is this your first go at the 360-degree flattened composite photograph? And if not, what sets this body of those photographs apart from like previous entry points into it?
I just checked yesterday. In 2021, it wasn't that long ago. And so most of these photographs were made over a two-year period. My projects typically last 4 to 7 or 8 years. So this is a very young project. And this project was interrupted by us moving. We just arrived in Massachusetts just a little bit over a year ago. I backed into this. I have been a professional photographer. I photographed the landscape personally for me, but I photographed architecture for clients. As a professional, I was interested in new technologies, and this technology is what is used by a lot of real estate photographers for their virtual reality, say the home tours, but you also see it in the Google Street View. And so I was interested in an entirely different way of seeing. What I discovered is that I only had a modest interest in the virtual reality. Yet, an intermediate step of producing those 360 virtual experiences was producing these photographs. It was that intermediate step that caught my attention, and that's how I got here.
Thank you. Okay, the big question. How did you make these? If you could talk a little bit about maybe the process, maybe not so much the technical, but what is the process? So people have observed that there are like arches in it. I think if you've walked around, you've noticed that there's a lot of repeating figures in it. So how do you make them in on the briefer side? Because I think we could spend the whole hour talking about this.
There are many ways that other people make these photographs, and they can make it with a single capture. They have cameras that have 180-degree lenses on either side. And they make a click and they can capture. But I wanted to do it in high resolution. So I use a digital SLR, which is you know, what many photographers use now. It's on a tripod and it rotates, and I make a whole series, a minimum of 40, but to make this picture here over 10 days, I think I made a total of 900 exposures. Now, they're not all in that photograph, but I'm saying that I made a lot of exposures. And I later stitched them together. The requirement is to make photographs that overlap, and so that you can find registration points when you stitch them together. So that's how I do it, and then I use various programs to put it together.
That was impressively brief, thank you. Okay, so composite photos, so several hundreds sometimes of images that are stitched together. So how do we as viewers approach them? How can you orient us when I walk up to this? How should I understand what I'm looking at or where I am in relation to the image?
Okay, this is where it gets tricky. So if this right here is exactly beneath my feet, right here at the center of the, okay? And this over here is exactly overhead. Because the camera is being pointed in all directions like this, you might think of this image as the interior surface of a basketball, okay? And if your eyeball was at that center point of the basketball, you would then see things as we normally perceive them. But when you take that basketball and you open it up and you spread it apart, okay, then the very top point gets stretched on, to either side. And the bottom gets stretched to either side. Okay? So this is blows a lot of people's minds, but so this point right here is immediately beneath you too. And that's because this point, which is the center, which is exactly the top, is a single point that stretches all the way across. And it's the same thing for the top. The center line is completely undistorted, okay? But it gets, and you can see actually the pattern of how things are distorted. This was just a canopy, a fiberglass corrugated canopy. And it's a rectangle with parallel supports. So you get a pretty good idea of how things are distorted there. Now, the interesting thing, I think, is that the algorithm that does this distorting, it does the same thing to pixels every single time. So there's no change. Every one of these photographs went through the same algorithm, and every one of the pixels at a certain XY coordinate got distorted exactly the same way. The key difference is the information I fed to the algorithm, okay? And so that's the photography aspect. And so if it were a blue sky above the scene, then you wouldn't actually be able to tell that it's getting stretched. It's just a blue sky.
Well, I think maybe to continue that line of thinking, if we come to one that has like a really clear sky like this one, you were sort of talking about distortion and the decision-making process of how to kind of allow for a sort of continuity within an image. So do you want to maybe talk a little bit about those choices of like how you sort of engage with the stitching of images and things like that, where there's sort of like a, I don't know, evening creeping into day sort of aspect of that?
As I said earlier, I like to photograph purposefully. And that means two things. First is I don't make a photograph just because I can make a photograph. I make a photograph because I want to have that photograph. I can make a great composition just about anywhere. I mean, any professional photographer can, but I can also. And then I realized that after a certain point that I don't want to own these things, you know? Why make a photograph? And I make a photograph when I have something to say, and that's the purposeful aspect of it. So I bring up my camera when I'm I'm intrigued by something. There's some idea I wanted to explore, or there's something I'm very appreciative in my life, and I wanted to honor that with a photograph. So, in this particular picture, and it's a little bit unusual because it's different from others. In this particular picture, I wanted to show the transition from night into day. It's a different rendering of time, okay? So in the other photographs, when you see a person appear in different locations, it's addressing time, but it's doing it through the law of continuity. People don't just disappear and reappear. If they were here, and later they were there, and then later they were there, there was a sequence to that event. And what I would like is when people look at these photographs, they try to reassemble what that sequence is, and that's a story. That's what I'm trying to do, and that's how I address time in most of my photographs. But in this one, I wanted to address time differently. And so it's 4 o'clock in the morning here, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning there. And it's a 360-degree photograph, okay? And that means that if you were to wrap that side all the way over here, in the other ones, if you did that, it would be seamless. In this one, you would have a very stark line, you know, dividing the two.
Great. Yeah, that's a little bit brain bendy. I would like to come back. You started talking about the people in your photographs. And to me, when I look at them, the people are really kind of the stand-ins or the sort of indicators of narrative. So I would love to ask you if you could tell us a little bit more about the stories that are embedded within each photo and how we should sort of understand or approach the narrative aspect.
So let's take this one for example. Being a photographer, I'm in the art world, and so I know a lot of artists, and I think that artists are very interesting. And my wife, Heather, has a friend. This is Heather. And that's our friend Tara. And Tara's dad is an artist up in Vermont. And Heather had visited Tara and said, oh, this guy is really, he's really cool. And his artwork, I'm telling you this story, but okay, here we go. his artwork is, he loves to pick up rocks, riverbed rocks that are nice and smooth from all that tumbling, and he paints faces on them. And he has thousands of them. I mean, he just can't help. He can't help it. He just does it. But now, to me, that's interesting. You know, it's somebody who just has a passion in life, and they just go and they're doing it. And it's like he just wants to do it. And so I wanted to photograph him, but he's very elderly. And when we went in, we were visiting. We arrived in the afternoon. Tara and her sister and the dad were there, and we had a lovely conversation. And then the next morning, he got up and he was painting his rocks there on this dining room table. I said, "Just paint away. I'm going to be here for 45 minutes, you know, doing this." And then he was just peaceably working, and I was peaceably working right next to him. But I also remembered that the previous night, that Tara and her sister, after dinner, they both love playing the flute. And so since Tara was visiting, and she doesn't visit all that frequently, they were just playing the flute with each other, which is one of the ways that they bond. And they were playing over here. Now, the previous night, I wasn't prepared to photograph, but when I was photographing Dorian, who's the artist, I wanted to recreate that, so I asked Tara to go over here and play the flute again so that we would have something happening in another part of the photograph. And as I was photographing, Heather and Tara were making lunch or something. I don't actually remember, but there was life going on. And so that's one of the nice things about these narratives. They capture life in a discrete way that is not, we talk about being staged and directed, and I don't like the word staging a photograph, because that's like if you go into an empty room and then you import all the elements of the photograph and then you photograph it. To me, that's staged. You have an additive creative process, and it's completely controlled. I like to go out into the world, and I manage, or I direct what happens. What I'll do is I'll set certain events in motion, and then photograph what happens then. And I don't necessarily have control over what happens. I can direct it a little bit. So for example, I was able to tell Tara, "Tara, you know, I really loved it when you were playing the flute yesterday. Can you play it again?" And so there, that is. With Heather and Tara there, they were just doing their things. I wanted to incorporate the element of time, that's important to me. And I asked Dorian to, that's his bedroom in the back, and I said, "Well, I saw you walk out of there this morning. Can you just replicate that for me for my photograph?" And he did. So there's a lot of direction going on in here. I agree with that. But it's something that's unfolding, and I don't necessarily know what's going to happen.
Great, thank you. Okay, I think for my next question, I kind of wanted to point out two images where the format is a little bit different. So there's Fire Island Ferry, which is outside of this room, but on the back wall back there. And then there's another one sort of outside and around the corner, which is Heather, Tom, and Two Socks. And so those are different. So my sort of approach was like, instead of that basketball being opened up, it's like kind of the opposite, where the basketball kind of like folded in on itself. So I was wondering if you could talk about that kind of presentation, maybe the decision about it. And then I have a sort of second follow-up question, which is about how the format is linked to interpretation. So whether those two and or the photo cube, which is kind of a different way right here on the pedestal of displaying that. So how do you see the format and the interpretation linked or not?
Okay, so for every one of these photographs in this show, I photographed exactly the same way. Okay, the camera's in a tripod, and I take lots of pictures looking in all different directions. That is basically the starting point, and there's no difference at all in that. The way that one interprets that information can differ. Those are called projections. And so this is called an equirectangular projection, okay? The spherical one where it looks like a little planet, that's called, I believe it's called a little planet. And the inverse of that is the one that you're, instead of being a globe, it's like you're inside a tunnel. It's just inverting those things. I'll tell you what I think about that, because I think it is relevant, and you guys have to listen. There's a film way long ago called Rashomon, and it's a classic. An event happens, and various witnesses are called before the court to relate what happened at that scene. And what's interesting is every one of those witnesses saw the same thing and had a different story. That's how I view our perceptions. We all may see something, but the stories we take out of it are all our own. They're all different. So with respect to photography, we've normalized, we are so used to conventional photography that we associate the word real with it. That's the way it really was, okay? But in truth, that's one of the ways of representing what really happened, and this is no more real than the way we're used to. We're not familiar with this, but it is as valid as straight photography. The question comes to me, how do you choose which way to express yourself? It depends on what you want to say. And I think that for storytelling, by and large, this presentation is the best. because the others are even more distinctive, I'll say. But let me go back to an earlier comment about the various projections and the fact that I was photographing topography. If you go outside the door and just to the left, there is a photograph of a basketball court. It's very difficult to identify that as a basketball court, okay? And that's what I liked about it. But I'm going to show you a different picture. I'm going to pass this around so you can see it, but it's a little planet. You just need to see it from a distance to get the point, but you can look at it more closely when it reaches you, okay? That photograph uses the exact same information as the one of the basketball court, okay? That is a different expression of the same thing. And what does that say to me? That's the distinction between something that's factual and something that's truthful. Something that's factual, in my view, is something that is scientifically independent and objective. But we all have our truths. So how we perceive things is our own way of doing that. And that's the point of my photographs. In my photographs, I'm trying to express what I consider to be truths, but they're interpretive. I know that they're interpretive, and I'm calling attention to the fact that they're interpretive by choosing these various formats.
Great. I might ask one more question before we turn it over to Q&A. Kind of going back to what you said about the idea of a photograph being real, and then also the title of this, which is An Entanglement of Space and Time, it feels like there's an allusion to sort of like a philosophical element or a metaphysical element. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on your thoughts about how your work does or doesn't intersect with that, because it's a question that comes up.
Thank you. When I first tried explaining this work to people, that was exactly how it started, and I evolved now. Go for the stories. So My initial interest was topography, as I mentioned, and we were in Princeton, New Jersey at the time, that's where we lived. And a friend looked at these photographs and said that these are really a good conceptual illustration of relativity theory. Space and time are entangled. And I had never thought about it that way, but it's true. I mean, in physics, they talk about some really wild things. And I'm very comfortable having this be nestled within the context of scientific conceptual illustration. But I don't hold myself as a physicist or an expert on it to comment on that. I'll let other people do that. But I do see time bending and space folding.
Okay, we won't hold you to that. I think now, if anybody has a question they'd like to ask that hasn't been addressed, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm speaking for Dan, who spells and doesn't speak. Dan says, so many of your images have other images inside them, and would you make a picture of this room at this moment, which seems like it would be a very interesting challenge to the way that you work because of all of the images and all of the people in it.
Yeah. Wow, okay. I can't really do that because I don't have my camera and tripod and I'll be here for 45 minutes. But that's exactly the concept that we had in this photograph over here. The idea that I wanted to address is that in all of my previous experience in photography, up until this photograph, I was out in the world and I saw something and I was inspired to photograph and I either photographed it or came back to photograph it. But I was visually stimulated by something that was out there. What's different about this picture is I had an idea, and I wanted to photograph the idea, and I had to give that idea form. And the idea was the life cycle of a gallery show. And so I wanted to photograph work coming down from the previous show, the gallery being prepared, my work going up in the gallery, and then the reception itself. And that's all in this photograph here. And in fact, the question earlier is, where are we standing? I'm standing right there. And you can see that picture in that picture, to Dan's point right there. Yeah, thank you, Dan.
When you talk about stitching photographs together, are you using Photoshop?
I'm using four programs, but the stitching itself, I'm using a program called PTGUI. P stands for photographs. I don't know what T stands for. GUI is Graphical User Interface. It's a program that specifically is used for that. Yeah.
In the age of AI, because I teach middle schoolers, and they're starting to learn the aspects of AI and the simpler way of doing things. So AI and even 3D 60 cameras, as you brought up. How do you maintain the drive and innovative push those creative boundaries? And what would you recommend for the youth in that sense?
That's a great question. Okay, well, to begin with, there is a certain class of people, and it's a large class of people, who are curious and they want to do something, and they have the experience of waking up in the morning and wanting to get out of bed because they have something to do. Anybody who has experienced that once will not only know it, they'll say, I want that every day. So the advice I would give for teachers is to keep stimulating, providing experiences for students to find, so that they may experience whatever unique thing it is that they need or would like to do, but also by modeling it. And in my case, I feel alive when I'm doing this. And the irony is that time stops when I'm that involved. I know many of you, if not all of you, have experienced exactly what I'm talking about. And all I can say is that there's a tremendous difference between a passion and a hobby. Yeah, good question. Yes?
This is kind of a strange question, but when I look at your photos, one of the things that most delights me is going back 700 or 800 years to a time when painting, which was sort of the photography of its day, told stories this way, multiple appearances of the same character, like religious painting, story of Adam and Eve, and you'd see all the different episodes, different sizes scattered through the field. Were you thinking of that at all?
Yes. So a previous project to this, in history, you have the bas-reliefs of various rulers conquering their enemies, and the Egyptian hieroglyphs, you see the whole narrative in the story. So in a previous project to this, I was addressing specifically space. I was working in this project called Figuring Space, and I wanted to understand space. If you think about space, this is going to get to your question. If you think about space, we can't see it, we can't touch it. We're only aware of space when it ends. You need a boundary to understand, oh, that was space before. So that raised the question for me, how do you photograph space? And what I did is I created a box, and I better give credit, the original idea was my wife's, but I constructed this box where the sides of the box exactly matched the proportions of my viewfinder, and so that if I moved the camera right to the edges of the box, it would seem as if a figure that I placed inside the box was pushing against the edges of my viewfinder. That's the idea. And I said, okay, I'm going to define a space, and how can I suggest that space? The space is what's in the box. And in this case, this figure is trying to measure space, and he's measuring it with a string, which has no increments, which means, what does that measurement mean? and then when I was thinking about that space, then I was thinking about depth. You know, sometimes space is deep and sometimes it's shallow, and that brought me to these bas-reliefs of the ancient rulers. The stela would basically tell the story of their great achievements. And the king would typically be very large and very aggressive and be trampling his enemies, who were smaller and all that. And they were, that whole story was told in a very narrow depth. So I said, well, how can I represent that space inside that box differently? So I told you earlier that I think a lot. This is an example of that. I was photographing space before, and there was narrative in that space. And so now I'm introducing time here, and but carrying forward the narrative.
Oh, yeah. Maybe one more question, and then after that, if anybody wants to ask up close and personal, we'll do that.
In terms of the constraint of having the camera on the tripod going in all directions, but not moving the tripod, did you also, when you were making that one, did you also take any close-ups of the rocks, or the rocks being painted, or the paint drying on the rocks, or over his shoulder, or the flute playing? I mean, the painting is animated by your feelings about things we can't really see. So the filmmaker in me kind of wants to sneak the close-up into it. With the painting behind you, I feel like you did a certain amount of that. Like you put in things that we could see in a way that we wouldn't quite be able to see them if there was only one distance to the lens.
You raise a good point, and a parallel question that sometimes comes up. I've had painters come in and look at this work, and they say something to the effect, "Oh, that is so cool! You ought to crop it like this." And
I didn't mean that.
I know. No, I know you didn't mean that. There's a conceit here, and the conceit is that I'm following a format. Just like in poetry, there's a sonnet with a certain rhythm to it, in haiku also. And you can't, if you want to make a sonnet, you have to follow that format. And in these photographs, they're all 360 degree images. So to make a 360 degree image, you can't move the tripod. It has to be in one location. So that's not a choice. But I do feel the need for exactly what you're describing. So I do make films. And in the films, then I'll zoom in. If you go to my website,
www.ricardobarros.com/entanglement-video.
A video will pop up with these images, and then we zoom around and you're going to see different aspects.
Thank you.
Okay.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you